European gas prices rise after the Nord Stream gas pipeline from Russia to Europe suffers damage, raising concerns over the bloc's energy security. Self-proclaimed republics of Donetsk and Luhansk and two other regions of Ukraine hold the fifth and final day of referendums on joining Russia. More than 500,000 homes and businesses are still without power in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Fiona hit 10 days ago. It's good to have you with us. The Russia-built Nord Stream pipelines to bring gas to Europe via the Baltic Sea have sustained damage in one single day, and that according to the operator of the network. Swedish authorities issued a warning of two leaks on the Nord Stream 1 pipeline overnight shortly after a leak on the nearby Nord Stream 2 project was discovered. Danish and Polish officials have raised fears of sabotage. The European Commission, however, says it's still premature to speculate. It's calling for investigations. Russia says that no option should be ruled out, including sabotage. And that's why Ukraine has blamed the leak on what it calls Russia's terrorist attack. Following the leak, gas prices hike further in Europe, raising concerns over the bloc's energy security. The voting has ended in four Ukrainian regions in referendums on accession to Russia. And Moscow says its main concern is saving the residents of those regions.
Saving people from the territories where this referendum is taking place is at the primary focus of our society and country's attention.
The voting took place in the self-proclaimed republics of Luhansk and Donetsk in the east, and the Russian-controlled parts of Kherson and Zaporizhia. Russian media says first partial results show at least 96% of the residents are in favor of joining Russia. Moscow already announced it would give full protection to the regions if they voted to become part of the country. Western countries have slammed the vote as illegal and a sham, and they say that they will not accept the outcome, whatever it could be. The EU has warned of consequences for the organizers of the votes.
There would be consequences for all people who participate in the illegal, illegitimate referenda, but we're not commenting on preparing the list of sanctions. That's the policy that we've had for a while. That's a member state issue.
Ukraine has urged Brussels to impose economic sanctions on Russia over the referendums. The foreign minister says the personal sanctions would not suffice for punishment. Dmitry Kuleba made a comment after meeting with his visiting French counterpart. Ukraine has already warned those involved in the referenda and the Moscow-held territories will face treason charges. According to Russian media, Putin is expected to formally declare the accession of the four regions to Russia on Friday if they vote to break away from Ukraine. In 2014, the Crimea Peninsula formally separated from Ukraine and joined Russia following a referendum. Politic analyst Tim Kirby says the referendums can be seen as game changers in the ongoing Ukraine war.
Now that they're going to become a part of Russia proper, this really changes the rules. This is no longer some sort of means of assistance, but any attacks that would be on Russia would be considered to be essentially an act of war against Russia itself. In fact, they've already declared, as many political analysts assume today, that this is going to turn into an anti-terrorist action, I believe was the proper terminology, to remove the rest of the Ukrainian forces from these four regions. However, if they continue to fight, then real traditional total war, in the sort of World War II sense of total war, would be declared, and that would change the nature of the conflict very much.
Since the beginning of the conflict in Ukraine in late February, Kiev's Western allies have only contributed to escalate the war further. And this has been done by allocating billions of dollars in military aid to Kiev and also sending weapons there. And this approach has only complicated the situation and led to the shrinking of the chance to reach a peaceful resolution to end the war. Seemingly, the war has no plans to change this trend.
The United States will provide $457.5 million in new civilian security aid for Ukraine. to help Ukrainian law enforcement and criminal justice agencies. This announcement by the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is one of Washington's many moves to provide support for Ukraine. Meanwhile, for the first time, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has acknowledged that his country has received sophisticated air defense systems from the United States. Zelensky admitted that Washington has provided Kyiv with the National Advanced Surface-to-Air Missile System that was long sought by his country. He thanked the U.S. for sending in the air defense batteries as well as other equipment, including HIMARS and other multiple rocket launching systems to counter Russian troops. Using all the heavy and long-range weaponry available to it, including HIMARS, Ukraine could jeopardize Russian logistics, vital supplies, and artillery power. These weapons also directly challenge Russia's air defenses, wiping out expensive advanced radars far behind the front lines. Ukrainian troops have launched a counteroffensive in the eastern region since driving Russian forces out of northeastern Kharkiv province earlier this month. Kyiv has also claimed its forces have made gains in the south. Ukraine has made repeated appeals to the West to send more weapons, including long-range artillery, while Moscow has accused Western countries of prolonging the war by giving Ukraine more arms. In total, the United States has committed approximately $9.8 billion in security assistance to Ukraine since Biden took office. This includes a variety of advanced military capabilities, including kamikaze drones and unmanned surface vessels. Previously, Russian President Vladimir Putin said Moscow might deploy nukes in case of an existential threat, accusing the U.S. and NATO of trying to blackmail Russia with nuclear weapons.
Even nuclear blackmail has come into play. We're talking not only about the shelling of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, encouraged by the West, which threatens unleashing a nuclear catastrophe, but also about the statements of some high-ranking representatives of leading NATO countries about the possibility and admissibility of using weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons, against Russia.
The U.S. National Security Advisor, however, warned Moscow of a decisive response over any use of nuclear weapons. Jake Sullivan also cautioned Russia of catastrophic consequences. That's while no country has ever used nuclear weapons on the battlefield except the United States. In 1945, the U.S. dropped two atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, killing over 200,000 people. Growing tensions have also prompted the U.N. Secretary General to once again call for a world free of nuclear weapons. Antonio Guterres urged an end to what he called an era of nuclear blackmail. He said any use of nuclear weapons would incite a humanitarian disaster.
Now, one of the main factors driving the strategic alignment between Russia and China is a perception of threats from the U.S. Washington is now busy with supporting Kyiv in its conflict with Moscow. It's actually a war between Russia and the U.S., as Washington and NATO are using Ukraine to fight a proxy war. But can the U.S. military fight on two major fronts in case of an escalation with China? According to U.S. Defense News, Washington will not be able to stomach it.
Forced drawdowns since the end of the Cold War and 20 years of fighting in the Middle East have left the U.S. military a shell of its former self. And now Washington is preoccupied with the war in Ukraine as it has become a proxy war between Russia and the West. The U.S. found the war in Ukraine a perfect opportunity to attempt to take on Russia using Kyiv. That's while Russia has challenged Washington's military superiority as a world power. Russia has select advantages over the U.S. when it comes to certain capabilities. For example, the U.S. Army has approximately 6,000 tanks, while Russia has around 12,000 tanks. Russian tactical nuclear capabilities outnumber the U.S. by 10 to 1. But the U.S. must be worried about another world power, China, which has spent a significant portion of its economic output on its defense budgets. The Chinese government is rapidly expanding its military forces. Perhaps the most visible example of this is its shipbuilding program. At the end of 2020, the size of China's navy was approximately 360, compared to the U.S. Navy fleet of 297 ships. Analysts believe America would face difficulties if forced to take on two major fronts simultaneously. China has accused the U.S. of stirring separatist sentiments in Taiwan through diplomatic exchanges and arms sales to the island.
China will continue to work for peaceful reunification with the greatest sincerity and efforts. To realize this goal, we must combat Taiwan independent separatist activities with the firmest resolve and take the most forceful steps to oppose external interference.
Tensions between the two sides have soared over recent visits by the U.S. House Speaker and other American lawyers to Taiwan. Therefore, while the U.S. is fighting a proxy war in Ukraine and while its chances to win a war against China in case of an escalation are thin, shouldn't Washington change its policies?
More than half a million homes and businesses in Puerto Rico are still without power and drinking water, and that following last week's devastating hurricane. Fiona slammed to the Caribbean island on September 18th, causing power outages and plunging nearly 3 million residents into darkness. Locals are still waiting for the restoration of basic services. Health officials have attributed 12 deaths to the storm. Meantime, the U.S. state of Florida is bracing for the worst storm in a century as Hurricane Ian churning toward the coast after making landfall in Cuba. It's expected to pack winds over 100 miles per hour along with heavy rains. Mandatory evacuations have been ordered for hundreds of thousands of Floridans in flood-prone areas. A new study shows implicit bias and racial disparities against Asian women working in the U.S. financial sector. The study is based on a survey conducted and published by a nonprofit organization, the Association of Asian American Investment Managers. Almost 60% of employees in investment management from a variety of backgrounds say that their racial identity has been a major impediment to their career. The trend of disparity was said to be higher at senior levels. Racial discrimination in the U.S. workforce continues to be a big issue, particularly among Asian Americans. The country has also seen a rise in anti-Asian violence. The killing of Michelle Goh in New York's Times Square in January is seen as part of hate-driven attacks against Asian Americans and has fueled discussion about racial bias in the financial sector. A coalition of right-leaning parties has won Italy's snap elections by a big margin. Giorgia Meloni, the leader of Voters of Italy, the party that received the most votes, is slated to become the country's first female prime minister.
As largely predicted by pollsters, the Brothers of Italy party has won the most votes in Italy's snap election, leading a right-wing coalition to victory. The turnout for the general election was about 64%, the lowest percentage ever recorded, around 9 points lower than the 73% turnout for the 2018 general election. Brothers of Italy, a group founded 10 years ago by its leader, Giorgia Meloni, grabbed more than 26% of the vote, while its allies, the League and the more moderate Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia, received respectively 9 and 8%. Meloni said on Monday that a future centre-right government would not betray the trust of the Italian people.
Questo è il tempo della responsabilità.
This is a time for responsibility. This is a time in which, if you want to be part of history, you must realize that we have responsibility towards millions of people who chose us. We won't betray it, like we never have.
Meloni's flagship policies include defending traditional social values, anti-immigration programs, and the reduction of taxes. Meloni is slated to become the next prime minister, the first woman in Italy who has ever been appointed to that position. The news that a coalition led by Brothers of Italy won a decisive victory in Italy's snap elections has been welcomed by far-right parties from across Europe. The Brothers of Italy has relentlessly advocated for a free Europe, including sovereign countries, and promoted traditional values and essentialist conceptions of gender.
Certainly it won't be an easy task for Meloni to reassure the EU, other international partners and the moderate electorate, and at the same time maintain a strong connection with international populist groups and a more radical electorate. I don't think Meloni will ever find a way to mediate between these issues. That's why I believe her policies won't be too bold.
Among the defeated coalitions in Italy's national elections was the Democratic Party, growingly seen by a large number of Italians as the party of the establishment. Its leader Enrico Letta conceded defeat early on Monday, adding that his party would be the largest opposition force in the next parliament.
It is evident that mistakes were made. I will lead the next party until the next Congress, when a new leader will be determined.
According to the Italian constitution, newly elected members of the parliament must now meet within 20 days. The country's president, Sergio Mattarella, will begin consultations on who should be appointed as the new prime minister with the presidents of the Senate and Chamber of Deputies, the leaders of the main parties, and at a later stage, with parliamentary groups. Max Civili, Rome.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, it was said that Imam Khomeini protested to the ratification of the scandalous bill known as capitulation in the Iranian parliament in 1963. The Imam, in his speech, castigated the parliament and the government, alarming the ulema and the nation against a great danger. Today, we are going to narrate the aftermath of Imam Khomeini's protest and his exile to Turkey. Stay tuned, please. One week after the release of Imam Khomeini's statement against the capitulation bill, the agents of regime arrested him. The Imam, in his statement, had called on the Iranian nation, the ulema, the army, the lawmakers, preachers, university students, and professors to break silence against this scandalous measure. He said, "The Iranian nation must break these chains. The Iranian army must not let such scandalous things happen in Iran and rather call for overthrowing of the government and expelling the lawmakers who have voted for this. The nation should ask their ulema not to keep silent in this issue. It is an obligation on the ulema of Islam to ask the sources of emulation not to ignore this issue. It is an obligation on scholars and teachers of seminaries to ask the great ulema to break silence. It is obligation on preachers to protest against this issue strongly and fearlessly and awaken the nation. It is an obligation on university professors to make the youth aware of what is behind the curtain. It is an obligation on university youth to oppose zealously against this scandalous plan and cause the voice of opposition to reach the world nations through sensitive slogans. It is an obligation on all the strata of the nation to forget their trivial and periodical conflicts and try in the way of the sacred goal of independence and exit from the shackles of captivity. The regime of Shah arrested Imam Khomeini at night as it was scared of people's reaction. Thus, the commandos of the regime assaulted the Imam's house and broke the door and climbed the walls of the house to arrest him. The Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, narrates, "On the night that they arrested the Imam, I was sleeping in a room with a wall next to the alley. I woke up from the sound and row of the crowd. I came out of the room to the veranda. I faced a strange scene there. The commandos of the Shah were climbing over our wall one by one. Almost every 30 seconds, one man would climb over, although the wall was high and there was no ladder. The sound of their gasp had filled the place, showing their anxiety. Suddenly, there was a sound of kicking the door between the interior and the exterior, and it was broken." Lady Saghafi says that at this time, the Imam was performing his midnight prayer. She continues, "The Imam was awake from the beginning, performing his midnight prayer and seeing everything. Then he gathered some things which he would need after the arrest, like the clay for prayer, handkerchief and comb. At that night, the door was broken and the Imam shouted, 'Keep quiet. Do not break the people's door. I will come myself. Why are you acting savagely?' He was speaking so impressively that there was silence everywhere and no one dared to move. Everyone was petrified. Everyone was standing where they were. No one was moving as if they were all electrified." In those critical moments of the Shah's commandos breaking into Imam Khomeini's house, not only the Imam didn't have the least fear, but he soothed his family, especially his wife. His wife says, "The Imam came to me slowly. I said, 'They arrest you as I said.' He said, 'Don't fear.' Then he took out the ring having his seal from his pocket and said, 'Keep this till you hear from me. Don't give it to anyone else. I put you under the care of God.' I bid him farewell and he went. They were taking the Imam by a Volkswagen and my son Ahmad was running behind the car. Between Ahmad and the car, there were a few agents as the main directors of the operation. Ahmad had chased them while throwing some stones on them, but they did nothing. Ahmad came back and sat beside me. I was lying under my blanket. He said jokingly, 'The lady is asleep.' Although I could tolerate these things, I was very sad. I went under the blanket not to transfer my sadness to Ahmad." One of the personnel of Imam Khomeini's house had related to Ms. Saghafi that the Imam had protested the agents of Shah for disturbing the neighbors. The lady says, "When the Imam reached the end of the alley, he told them with strong words, 'Aren't you ashamed? Why are you being so savage? Why are you disturbing the people? Why are you breaking the people's door? One of the commanders had told them to kiss the imam's hand as a sort of apology. The imam's wife continues, "This time, too, they took the imam by a Volkswagen to Fatemi Hospital and put him in a Mercedes there. But this time, they didn't switch on the Volkswagen. They just pushed the car as they didn't want to make this much noise, although they made so much noise that they woke up all neighbors. Anyone who opened the door would face an agent who ordered him to close the door. This was the condition along the way up to the hospital. They took the imam directly to the hospital and from there to Turkey." Imam Khomeini's wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, says that some of the agents of the regime felt sorry at their behavior with the imam and wept. The imam would calm them. Ms. Saghafi says, "The imam said that there were drivers in the cars and the man sitting by him would continuously contact Tehran and there were two people on my sides. One of them was crying up to the airport and I was soothing him. He was sad as why he had chosen the job to behave such with a man like me. The imam came across the Savak chief at the airport. He told the imam, 'You will go to Turkey.' The imam told him calmly, 'So much better.' The day after the imam's arrest, his elder son, Mustafa, was arrested by the agents of Shah." Lady Saghafi narrates, "The next morning, they detained my dear son, Mustafa, and released him after 57 days. They had proposed him in the prison that if he wanted, he could go to Turkey beside the imam. Mustafa told me the issue, and I told him that they want to deceive us. It means that you have gone on exile on your own. Moreover, you are more effective in Iran. Try to release your father rather than being exiled. Furthermore, your going to Turkey will decrease people's zeal and everyone will say, 'Thank God, the imam is not alone.' So he issued a message that he wouldn't go. Thus, they detained him again and this prevented him from being exiled. During the few days that Mustafa was in Qom, it was clear that he would not stay there as people would swarm and the commutations were different from the previous ones."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا O you who believe, اِسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is the member you are listening to. Today we invite you to listen to an English lecture by Brother Amin Rastani.
أعوذ بالله السميع العليم من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد اللهم صل على محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين واللعن الدائم على أعدائهم أجمعين. My condolences on the shahadat of Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam. in these nights, as we get closer and closer to the end of the Muharram and Safar season, the season of mourning, you think more and more about, okay, we have spent all of this time remembering Aba Abdullah alayhi salam and the other Ahlul Bayt whose shahadat were in these nights and in these 2 months. And so in the end, we have to understand that all of this is so that the teachings of Islam are preserved, so that we can embody the teachings of Islam within us. Last night, we had that hadith by Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, where he spoke about what the expectations are for a muhib and lover of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wa sallam. A lover of Ahlul Bayt will stand out. You can identify them through their ibadah, through other things. Muslim bin Awsajah, how was he identified? By that spy of Ubaidullah bin Ziyad. How were they able to identify Muslim bin Awsajah, who was close to Muslim bin Aqil? They were looking for Muslim bin Aqil, correct? How were they able to identify Muslim as one of the companions, or excuse me, Muslim bin Awsajah as one of the companions of Muslim bin Aqil? How? They noticed that he's doing the most ibadah in the masjid. And they said, this one must have some ties with. Brothers and sisters, as Shia, we need to stand out because of our relationship with the Quran. Because of our ibadah, because of our tawheed and all of that. There's so much to say in this regard, but we don't have time for it. So those were expectations. I'm a muhib of Ahlul Bayt. I love Ahlul Bayt. Oh, that's wonderful. Let me see what you got. Let me see what, how's that affecting your life. I mean, Rasulullah is telling us there's expectations. Or else the love is there, inshallah. And as I said last night, inshallah, it will help us whenever we need it. Oh, man, but that love can do so much more as well. Imam al-Ridha is very special. I'll say this much, that the imams that came after Imam al-Ridha, they were all referred to as Ibn al-Ridha. Oh, this is Ibn al-Ridha, Imam al-Hadi. Ibn al-Ridha, Imam al-Askari. Yeah, Imam al-Jawad, of course, Ibn al-Ridha. Because he was one of those turning points. He was very important to the extent that our scholars will talk about how Imam al-Ridha, his journey to Tus and from Medina all the way to Tus and Khurasan is kind of similar to Imam Hussein's journey from Medina to Karbala, in the sense that they both, these journeys both secured Islam. Yeah. As-salamu alayka ya Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha. Allahumma salli ala Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha al-Murtadha al-Imam al-Taqi al-Naqi wa hujjatika ala man fawqa al-Ard wa man tahta al-Thara al-Siddiq al-Shahid salatan kathiratan tammatan zakiyatan mutawasilatan mutawatiratan mutaradifah كأفضل ما صليت على أحد من أوليائك. As I said, Imam al-Ridha is very special, very special. What's happening in his shrine right now, God knows. Thousands and thousands in and out, gathering to show their love and respect to the holy Imam who becomes shaheed on a night like this. God knows how many lives Imam al-Ridha has touched, brothers and sisters, God knows. To the point that the likes of Allama Tabatabai, he says, when you enter his haram, he is Al-Imam Ar-Ra'uf, the kind, merciful Imam. What do you mean? Do you mean other Imams are not kind? They're not Ra'uf? No, he says, it's just when you walk in there, you just sense it differently. Al-Imam Ar-Ra'uf. And so there's a reason why we single him out, even when in our ziyarat. As-salamu alayk, ya ghareeb al-ghuraba. The same way Ali and Al-Akbar, he fell far from the tents. He's very ghareeb. Yes, distance plays a role in ghurbah. Imam al-Ridha, why are you all the way out somewhere else while all the other imams are either buried in Medina or in Iraq? And I want to say, oh Imam al-Ridha, we have wept for your grandfather, Imam Hussein, for 2 months. And now we have this honor as we slowly leave the month of Safar to cry for your musibah. What an honor. It's narrated that when Ma'mun forced the Imam to migrate from Medina to Khurasan, just like his father Imam Hussein had to migrate, Imam al-Ridha, He does exactly what Imam Hussein does. Imam Hussein, in the reports that he went to the grave of his grandfather, the Holy Prophet, he would speak to him, go out, go back in again. Several times we have reports of the Imam doing that. Imam al-Rida, it says he did the same thing. It says he went to the grave of his grandfather several times and he wept. And he also told his family to come around him and weep for him as he was leaving. What are you doing, Imam al-Rida? What are you trying to say? He's trying to say, this is a journey I will not return from. If I'm going and I'm going to be the successor to Ma'mun, as he calls it, don't fall for it. No, this is a journey I will not return from. And he doesn't take anyone from his family members with him. He goes alone. Yes, Gharibul Ghuraba for a reason. And so they write that when the time came for Imam al-Rida to leave this dunya, he was summoned by Ma'mun, the one who had his own brother's head in front of him. Ma'mun killed his own brother for Khilafah. So he's not going to have mercy on Imam al-Rida. It says that Imam al-Rida, as he is summoned to go to Ma'mun, he tells his companion Abu Salt, "Oh Abu Salt, wait for me to return from Ma'mun. If I return with my cloak over my head, don't speak to me, for I have been poisoned." So Abu Salt says, the Imam went and I sat there looking at the door, hoping, praying. I hope the Imam doesn't come back with the cloak over his head. And so after some time passes, all of a sudden he says, I saw the door open, and lo and behold, the cloak was drawn over the head of the madhloom Imam. And he couldn't walk properly. He would keep having to sit and sometimes maybe fall. Some accounts say Abu Salt says he fell 50 times before he made it back. Abu Salt, my liver is burning. What did this poison do to the body of Imam al-Rida? It says after some time, the Imam puts aside the rug in his home, exposing the sand under it. And what he does is he sticks his abdomen to this cold sand, probably to cool off the fire that's burning within him. It says as he did this, he was yatamalmalu tamalmul as-salim, like a snake that's been injured. It's twisting and turning in pain. Imam al-Rida is twisting and turning in pain. As all of this is happening, it says that he kept looking at the door as if he's waiting for someone. And eventually, it says Imam al-Jawad enters upon his father. A young Imam Jawad puts his father's head in his lap as the soul of the Imam is departing. Allahumma salli ala alihi Musa al-Ridha al-Murtaqa. Allahumma salli ala alihi Musa al-Ridha al-Murtaqa. Wa hujjatika ala man fawqa. متواصلة متواترة مترادفة كافل ما صليت على أحد من أوليائي.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
As the U.S. continues its efforts to prolong the crisis in Eastern Europe, the European continent faces the grim prospect of deindustrialization and deep recession. The question that comes to mind is that why should European households pay for a conflict which is instigated by the U.S. regime? In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. Global Times wrote, "Deindustrialization, which has been hotly discussed in Europe recently, overshadows the efforts of Western developed countries to rebuild their industrialization. Deindustrialization is not new in Western countries. Since 1970s, industries in Europe and the US have been moving out of their countries for comprehensive reasons. But the newest wave of deindustrialization Europe is facing this time is largely influenced by a single effect, that is, rising energy prices and imported inflation, further exposing all old problems that already existed. Now, electricity and gas prices have soared because of Russia-Ukraine crisis. In an open letter to EU leaders, including Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, European Industry Association, Euromax, raised the alarm about Europe's escalating energy crisis posing an existential threat to industry, calling on EU and member state leaders to take emergency action to preserve their strategic electricity-intensive industries and prevent permanent job losses. Global Times added, growing costs will cause a lack of industrial raw materials in Europe, including metals. Together with soaring energy prices, as well as the rise in import prices, due to the devaluation of the euro, the decline of profit margins will bring troubles to both the enterprises and the broader manufacturing industry. As a result, the effects of the Russia-Ukraine crisis are another burden on Europe's unresolved problem of past deindustrialization. Of course, decision-making errors also contribute to the current energy shortage in Europe, with some countries having put forward radical energy transition goals, including the decision to phase out nuclear power, the negative impact of which has just been catalyzed by the crisis in Ukraine. Facing energy difficulties, some European countries were forced to boost coal use or extend the life of some nuclear reactors, which now leave them further away from Europe's earlier energy ambitions. Wang Xu, a professor at the School of International Relations of Beijing Foreign Studies University, told the Global Times. Moreover, the EU had proposed a ban on long-term contracts to import natural gas into the bloc to end its reliance on foreign producers before the Russia-Ukraine crisis broke out, leaving no access for temporary purchases now. If the German economy, the engine of European economy, slows down while its export-oriented model is hit, the entire Eurozone economy will be affected, likely resulting in a technical recession in Europe from next year, according to Wang. What's worse, there is not much hope for Europe to come up with any solutions in the next few years for energy shortages. Governments in the EU may have to turn to subsidies in facing higher prices of electricity, gas and oil, which draws another problem of where does the money comes from. Meanwhile, the European Central Bank has announced measures to tighten monetary policy in response to growing inflation, a policy which contradicts the proposal of potential large-scale subsidies. As a result, there is limited policy space for Europe, which will suffer more if the energy crisis drags on as the Russia-Ukraine conflict continues to prolong and escalate. However, Europe, despite being an important stakeholder during this crisis, does not have the ability to address the problem since it is unable to influence the resolution of the conflict. Indeed, there will be growing coordination between US and Europe in terms of monetary and economic policies due to the US concerns the conflict brings about broader global market turmoil and affects US interests. But current U.S. policy seems to be deliberately pushing the world further toward a crisis, rather than easing it, given that the Federal Reserve has just raised interest rates by 75 basis points for the third consecutive time. In doing so, it is using its monetary policy to pass on its domestic economic crisis to other countries. Furthermore, once the growing deindustrialization of Europe becomes a reality, the U.S. may try to benefit from it by promoting the trend, because the U.S. will become a preferential destination of European industries that choose to leave the continent. This is the last thing Europeans want to see, which is to pay for the Russia-Ukraine conflict instigated by the U.S. regime. According to Forbes, with natural gas prices over $100 more per megawatt hour than they were a year ago, the Western European economies are heading to the Middle Ages. Forests are being cut for firewood as Russia retaliates with its own Ukraine crisis sanctions by shutting off the trickle of natural gas. It was still piping into Europe. Germany, watching companies suffer high electricity bills, and is finally talking about decoupling from China. The energy crisis is making them nervous. They want to make it harder for manufacturers to outsource now that their energy bill is at an all-time high. This no longer looks like a short-term crisis. Stories from Western Europe are like stories one once heard in countries like Bolivia. High inflation and resource rations imposed by the state. Corporate investment goes where money goes farthest. It used to be taxes and labor and environmental costs they looked at. Now European companies will add electricity to the mix. None of this bodes well for European businesses. For this reason, new UK Prime Minister Liz Truss has given up listening to the climate lobby and said the country would end its fracking ban. Britain is in the same boat as the EU. Brexit didn't shield it from Europe's policy errors. Germany is signing long-term contracts for US LNG to save itself, though it will have to find a place to put it all. For this reason, they will have to build new terminals to handle those shipments quickly. But these actions should have been done years ago, or at least set in place before the Russian sanctions were announced. Europe had no ace up its sleeves. We now expect a deeper prolonged recession and more persistent elevated inflation due to the impact of higher energy prices, a more decisive European Central Bank tightening cycle and weaker demand, says Barclays Capital Economist, led by Silvia Ardana. According to Forbes, the European Central Bank raised its main leading rate 75 basis points to 1.25% last week. That's still historically low. But the EU economy has been so used to near zero rates that liquidity will start to dry up as capital costs rise. As the margin traders will think twice about buying securities on leverage, among other things. Vanguard's FTSE Europe is not a buy. This looks like the classic dead cat bounce. Barclays forecast a Eurozone recession in the fourth quarter that will persist until the second quarter of 2023, with a 1.7% contraction in real GDP. Some countries will be worse off than others. Barclays revised their growth rate down in January. Italy, France, and Spain. Germany will be the worst due to its high reliance on Russian gas and bottlenecks in transporting gas within Europe. Most pipe gas is from Russia. Italy is the second worst performer because it is highly dependent on natural gas to generate electricity, using it for about 50% of power generation. These factors mean Germany and Italy are more likely to face physical shortages, while the energy crisis represents more of a price shock for France than Spain, Barclays economist wrote recently. Inflation in Europe should peak at 9.3% in the fourth quarter. Barclays says that domestic drivers of medium-term inflation now look weaker than they did in June as demand slows and real incomes fall flat. Europeans will be spending a lot on fuel. Natural gas prices are up by around $170 per megawatt hour over the last 12 months. In the U.S., the experts measure natural gas price by British thermal unit. Prices closed at $8.81 per million BTU for the nearby futures contract, while EU natural gas is around $50 per million BTU. Despite these inflationary headwinds, the ECB is seen raising rates by 75 percent points in October to fight inflation.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is Taqwa, Thursday the 2nd of Ramadan, 1394, 19 September, 1974. Surah Ali Imran, verse 132-134. And obey Allah and the Messenger so that you may be granted mercy. And hasten towards your Lord's forgiveness in a paradise as vast as the heavens and the earth, prepared for the God-weary, those who spend in ease and adversity and suppress their anger and excuse the people, and Allah loves the virtuous. Surah Ali Imran, Surah number 3, verse 132-134. To keep their hearts free from sin, some Christians adopted a monastic way of life. They sought refuge in the solitude of caves and mountains. The Quran says, "But as for the monasticism, they innovated it. We had not prescribed it for them." The Quran, Surah 57, verse 27. However, the Islamic scholar cannot live the life of a monk. He cannot withdraw from society. He cannot retreat to the mountains. The Islamic scholar is the one who rushes in to save others. A thinking Muslim is like this. Any Muslim person, insofar as being a Muslim and bearing moral responsibility go hand in hand, is like this. They rush to rescue one who is drowning, to save one who is in danger, to care for one who is sick. They do not run away.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A Muslim makes himself God-wary, muttaqi, by equipping himself with piety, taqwa, literally protection, meaning the necessary arms and armor to protect himself from sinning before entering the place of sin in order to take the sinners out. This is the essence of taqwa. If this is taqwa, does this mean that taqwa is a necessary requirement and means of attaining success or not? As you can see, the answer is straightforward. It is a means of attaining success. If someone wants to treat an outbreak of disease in a particular area, and he is constantly worrying that he will be infected just by being there, how can he possibly hope to save others from it? Before he can go to the affected area and rescue others, he must first be sure about himself. It is then that he will succeed. It is then that he can easily undertake his mission. As Allah says, "And be wary of Allah so that you might be successful."
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.